Hello and welcome to Behind the Buyouts, the deals podcast where we speak to private equity and venture capital practitioners about their deals and deal making. I'm your guest host, Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. We have with us today Andrew Weinberg, founder and CEO of middle market private equity firm Brightstar Capital. He's here to talk to us about the firm's strategy, its investments, and M&A expectations for 2025. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Nikita. Great to be here today.
So let's start with your career. I'd love to know how you found your way to Brightstar from working at firms like Lindsay Goldberg and Goldman Sachs. I'd love to know all the twists and turns that brought you here.
So I remember one of my first LP meetings when I founded Brightstar 10 years ago. And the person asked, how did you get here? And there was physically a way to get there, which was a bridge. And then there was the sort of, how did you get here? And I gave more of the 5-minute answer of how I got there. And he told me 95% of the people just say, I took the bridge. And 5% do the 5-minute version, which is, what journey did you take to get here? So I'll try to abbreviate it from the 5-minute, but it's been an exciting and fun journey so far. I was really lucky. I went to Dartmouth College and studied economics and history. I was a double major. I was always enamored. My grandfather taught history at Brooklyn College, and I was enamored of sort of learning from the past and applying it to the future. I think pattern recognition is very important. One of my favorite areas of interest actually was the Great Crash, and looking at all the prior crashes going back to the Dutch tulip craze and seeing what one could learn from that. I did my thesis actually on the Glass-Steagall Act, another outgrowth of the Great Crash. And fast forwarding, very fortunate to use that experience and work at great institutions like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, great training, great mentorship. And then a family office hired me that became a private equity firm, and I learned a ton there. And about 10 years ago, I picked up my head and said, you know what? I think I can do this. And I gathered together my tin cup. I got an extra pair of shoes because I knew I'd wear them out. And I started taking meetings and went from there.
Absolutely. And one of the most interesting things about Brightstar is obviously the trend that underpins its philosophy, which is this great wealth transfer that we've talked about before. But could you tell us more about that and how you present yourself as an exit option to these families?
Great. Thanks for the question. So I've been essentially investing in this generational wealth transfer for the last 25 years. And all we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years is a great acceleration in terms of the market opportunity to back these families, founders, and entrepreneurs. In our core market in the United States, it is now a $105 trillion opportunity. So a very large market of transitioning from one generation to another. To provide context, that's more than 100 times the amount of private equity capital that's out there and about 1.6 times the market cap of all US stocks. So a very large opportunity. As much as I'm giving you the macro data and the backdrop, I think it's very important to actually understand the mindset and the DNA of these families, founders, and entrepreneurs. And we ourselves have actually invested in proprietary research in the space. And here are the things we learned by working with Family Business Magazine and others, that 57% of families are unsure if the next generation will join the business. Just think about that for a moment. 20, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, if one of us grew up in a family business, the default was, mom or dad told me I'm going to work in the business. I'm going to do that now. More than half are now saying, I'm not sure. And over 60% of these family businesses do not have a formal succession plan. Let's pause on that. Great governance, public companies, there's a CEO in place. There's generally a succession plan if something were to happen to that CEO or a natural life cycle. And yet we're talking about this over $100 trillion opportunity. And if we said dollar for dollar, $60 trillion of it doesn't have a succession plan. That's an opportunity for us at Brightstar Capital Partners and for the private equity industry to be that partner of choice to enable that generational wealth transfer. It's not going to be every opportunity, but the market is so large, it's big enough for us.
Now, one of the big things that you do, you said it's not just about investing in these opportunities. It's also about educating these founders and families who don't know that this option exists for them. How do you navigate those conversations, especially in scenarios where they can be a little bit wary about private equity, as we discussed?
Well, Nick, I think you bring up a great point. I was raised in New York City, but a vast majority of our investing is not in New York City. It's really across the entire country. And headlines tend to be grabbed by the negative, not the positive. And so when there's a negative event around private equity, we hear about it. And we don't always hear about the great success stories in one of our companies turning three owners into 50 owners and all the positives that come from that, or the job growth that came from that. But focusing first on the marketing narrative, private equity can be a tough one for a number of families because they've generally known someone or known someone that knew someone that had a tough experience in private equity. So our job is to make sure that we really focus on building the relationship and don't focus on a transaction or the investment. That might be an outgrowth of a relationship that's built on trust, where we need to communicate two things. One is we do have capital to enable this transition. So simple math, there's one owner to start with in Gen 1, and four generations later, each of the branches had three children. We have almost 30 stakeholders at that point. Well, what if numbers 21 through 27 really are not as interested in being owners in that single asset without diversification and would rather have a more diversified portfolio? If it were a public company, there's a great mechanism to do that, which is you sell your stock. In a private company, there's not a great liquidity mechanism. And so we'd like to position ourselves as a partner of choice, but we don't do that by just being capital. We also need to bring the operational value add. I was fortunate enough to be trained by a mentor, Marcelo Clare, going back to 2007, 2008 during the GFC, and how to run a business. I was both a partner on a deal, and I also became a chief operating officer for a number of years of that company, a dual role. A number of my colleagues started life operating businesses and then did 20 years in private equity. So fast forwarding, if we can bring capital to the table as well as operational know-how, what we believe is that we can bring a better and a higher growth rate to these businesses than they could on their own. And that helps differentiate us in what is a very crowded field in private equity.
Now, obviously, family founder-owned is the focus. When you dive deeper into the firm's investment criteria, what's on the checklist when you're evaluating investments?
Our checklist really expands a few dimensions. One dimension is going to be sector focus. Does it fall into the four verticals where we invest and we've invested for more than 20 years? Is it business services, industrials, government services, and technology or consumer? Then we go to the next part of the checklist, which is, does this company have a great culture? Does this management team have the DNA to not only run the business that they run today, but run the one that we think they can scale with both organic growth and inorganic growth or acquisitions effectively to grow that business? Sometimes we invest in the market leader. Sometimes we invest in the disruptor who wants to become the market leader. And generally, these are cash flowing businesses. We've seen over the last 20 years, the ebbs and flows of sometimes excitement for cash flowing businesses and sometimes euphoria for more growth oriented, more interest rate sensitive investments. We've always focused on cash flowing investments because that's what we know how to do. We generally capitalize them appropriately with debt and equity, but never too much debt. And we look to basically grow those businesses again at what we think is a better rate than the company could on its own. And what we're most focused on is 5 or 10 years after we've exited that investment or been in that investment, a phone call might go into that family who we partner with or that founder or that CEO. And the question will be asked, should I work with Brightstar Capital Partners? And if the answer is yes, I know we'll be in business for a long time.
When you put all of these criteria together, is there EBITDA or revenue range that you prefer to focus on?
Yeah. So we've historically invested in businesses that have fallen effectively in that 10 to 100 million EBITDA range. Historically, we had done it all through one fund structure. And most recently, we actually hired a senior team from a lower middle market fund to address some of the companies at the lower end of that range with a distinct fund strategy, as well as focusing on our core flagship fund. A number of our businesses actually have exceeded the top end of that range as we've grown them from both organic and inorganic growth. And what we'll seek to do is generally within that 5-year timeframe, look for exit opportunities or liquidity events, which in some cases could be a full exit, or in other cases, like a deal we did in 2024, where we sold a majority of the investment to Genstar Capital and retained a minority stake, given how early we were in the fund life.
I want to talk a little bit more about sort of the four verticals that you focus on. What about those four verticals? Is there a common thread between them that made them so attractive to you that those are the things that you focus on?
Yeah, again, I'm going to come back to one of the first comments I made, Nikitha, which is pattern recognition. So we've been doing this for a long time, and our team is more than 50 people, 30 investment professionals focused on these core verticals. And the common theme, I would say, is a pricing strategy that could work in one sector generally has portability to work in the other sectors. And when you've done it enough times in that sector, if I take the collective experience of our team, we're talking about more than 200 investments in the last 20 years. There's a lot of knowledge and a lot of expertise to pull from, not only the investing side I referenced, but then the operational side of it. I'd say that we see in these sectors general resiliency to the market, especially in the businesses we choose to invest in. We generally have possibly an angle that maybe someone else, if they were looking at it, may not have in that investment. Although we do pride ourselves on having a number of these bilateral conversations where someone's truly picking a partner. And we now know with the data and the history of this over multiple cycles that these sectors have proved to be resilient for our investments.
Speaking of the businesses that you invest in and how one informs the other, I'd love to start with talking maybe about Best Choice Roofing, because I absolutely love facility services, as you know. Could you talk about how that investment came about, what was attractive about the company, and then maybe we can go further into the other investments that inform this one?
Great. Thank you for bringing this up. We recently invested in partnership with the founder and CEO in Best Choice Roofing, who himself is a meaningful investor and partner of ours going forward. I think it's safe to say we all love to have a roof over our heads, and so keeping a roof is quite important. This is a founder-owned business that we are now the majority partner in that's focused on the southern part of the country, which has a number of advantages, most notably the population growth from the southern part of our country. And given all the changes in the world, the likelihood of severe weather and the wear and tear from that in a product that is generally covered by insurance, so a non-discretionary item, where we found a need that having an expert who all they do every day is figure out how to manage the process of replacing a roof and what's a fairly valuable item, that's a great expertise to have. As a team in general, we try to focus again on finding these experts and finding these sector specialists, and we think we found one here. As it's played out, the industry itself, the private equity industry, has looked at a number of these opportunities and invested in them. So we see a number of our peers. We think we have found the gem of a company to invest in, which has been growing, you know, very scalably here. And we're looking forward to the upcoming years in partnership as we continue to grow this business.
How did Amerit and InfraServe come into the picture when you were evaluating Best Choice Roofing?
Thank you. Well, Amerit for us was a source of a great liquidity event in the fourth quarter. And going back in time, I had backed about 20 years ago an executive at a company that generated a great return for my former firm. And one of my rules of thumb is please stay in touch with people. And this has been a great relationship. And he maintained a relationship with the founders going back more than a decade. And so actually, I founded Brightstar in 2015. We started talking to the founders of Amerit. And for a number of reasons, something didn't come together at that time. And I'm a big believer in sliding doors in life. I met my wife when I was 17. I convinced her to date me when we were 27, and we just celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary. So I'm not sure if the person I was at 17 was the person who was going to be the person she married when we reconnected when we were 27. And I think in the case of Amerit, we stayed in touch with the company, and the right time came up in 2020. And Amerit for us leveraged a lot of what we had learned in another investment, InfraServe, which was our ownership of Bobcat Dealers, which we'll come to shortly. But Amerit had some great characteristics to it. A fleet maintenance business, a very stable business, really relies upon core skills of technicians and mechanics. That actually has evolved since we invested to effectively software engineers or those who are conversant in working on electric vehicles, because we didn't work on one when we invested. And now we have over 15 contracts signed in that sector. This is an essential service where we have helped the company, and they've had great leadership, really work on their value proposition to the market as they've more than doubled their headcount organically to serve their customer needs. We've also invested during that time in IT, employee retention, and that growth has created a more resilient business with significant margin expansion, revenue and profit growth, and resulted in a liquidity event for us last year. We leveraged in that investment a lot of what we learned around the parts and service space with our Bobcat dealers. So going back, we were very fortunate that Dan Onich, the Gateway business in St. Louis, trusted us to be his partner going back to our first fund. And Dan had a great and still has a great dealership business that we thought also was a great parts and service platform. And we learned a lot in a short period of time, especially during the pandemic, about how to make sure that, again, these essential pieces of equipment stayed in the hands of these businesses who needed it to operate. So this light industrial equipment, in partnership with the Bobcat parent company, for us was a backdrop of not just backing Dan, but two other groups that he knew well, two family-backed groups in his network that had been the dealer meetings with him that also were looking for a generational transition. By piecing together these three companies into one company with one culture, with one identity, we actually grew the ownership base from essentially three or four folks to more than 50. So we take a lot of pride at Brightstar of not only continuing to back those families who've trusted us, but creating new generations of ownership, some of whom might not have been the families themselves. So again, in the Amerit situation, really didn't use M&A as a tool for growth. And the Bobcat deal, we served as a consolidator in the space, which allowed us, we think, to be a more valuable partner to Bobcat.
That's really interesting. And when you talk about creating these 50 owners from three owners, and there are people now in the ownership that are not necessarily the family, are we talking about employees buying in? What does that look like?
Yeah, it's everything from employees who we consider our partners buying in. It's also granting them profit interest or stock options or other methods, which have a less burdensome upfront capital cost to them. And again, a number of these folks may not have economically been in a situation where they're not a fund. They don't have the necessarily ancillary capital to go invest, but we want to make sure we create an ownership culture. And so we wanted to make sure that we shared the upside with them. We think the knock-on effect is significant, where we can help improve the culture from one of what already is a great culture to one where you go from being an employee to an owner. And it's a different mindset. It's a different way to wake up. And you might focus on a couple of things or spend that extra 2-3% in your day focusing on making it a great business. And we're hoping as we transition that business to a great family office, whom we believe will probably own this for a very long period of time, that that ownership mentality continues. And the knock-on effects in these communities, because this type of business, some of it operates in larger metropolitan areas, but a number of it, the dealerships operate in more rural or suburban areas. We want to make sure that has a positive knock-on effect in the community.
Absolutely. Looking to the future and 2025 in particular, what's your pipeline like? Of the four verticals that you're focused on, where do you anticipate spending most of your time?
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you some historical data here. In the last 18 months, we executed 9 investments totaling more than $2.5 billion of enterprise value of transactions. It has been the single busiest period in Brightstar's history. Our pipeline in 2024 grew 30% year over year in terms of opportunities that we looked at. And we look at a lot of opportunities to do very few. So it was a busy period. My expectation is that 2025 will be even busier than 2024. And again, we talked about those four verticals. I would expect at least two of the four, industrials and business services, to be incredibly active for us. It doesn't mean the other two won't be active, but on balance, based on the data that we're seeing, I think those two will be incredibly active. In terms of what we're seeing in the market overall, I don't have a crystal ball. I think most do think that deal flow will increase. I think what we're already hearing and seeing is a regulatory environment that's more favorable to transactions. But I'm going to focus on what we control, which is our sourcing engine. And I had some great meetings to start the year with a number of different members of our investment team about what we can continue to do to improve our sourcing engine, and some great ideas coming out that we're implementing that I'm looking forward to talking about on a future call.
That's great. I know you don't have a crystal ball. You can't exactly predict what's going to happen in 2025 about M&A. So I'll take a step back and maybe look at something that has been a point of contention over the past couple of years, which is valuations. After 2021's historic highs, things have sort of slowed down. I think things have come back to reality a little bit, hopefully. But I'd love to hear what you're seeing in the market in terms of expectations from sellers.
Yeah, so I think there are effectively a couple of markets. There's the public market that we talked about that is at or near all-time highs and has a small number of stocks driving that. That's not the market we serve. Okay, but if someone ever references the pure equity capital markets, there are a few stocks that tend to drive most of that gain, and those tend not to be the businesses that we're investing in. In terms of valuation expectations, after what was an exuberant running up to 2021, where multiples were quite high, I mean, our average investment multiple has tended to be sort of under where the market is. We've seen definitely more reality. I think the reality is either no transaction, i.e. we're going to pause, or some moderated expectations. I'm not going to say there's a market change, that there's a massive shift, but I do think some reality has set in. I'm going to counteract that for a minute, which is the debt markets are actually quite strong and robust. And with the growth of private credit alongside the broadly syndicated loan market, we've actually never seen more options to finance our deals than now, with the only mitigant being that the base rate, that risk-free rate, is at a more elevated level now. So by definition, interest rates are higher for our cost of borrowing than they would have been in 2021. The market that we serve with families, founders, and entrepreneurs tends to be less correlated, I would say, to where valuations are in the market and as a part of the natural life cycle. Businesses and entrepreneurs and others don't sort of wait to age. Right. There's a natural transition point in these companies for the next generation of leadership, or industries themselves are quite dynamic and might demand capital for consolidation. And we think we've built a business model that's an all-weather fund that can survive all of those. I think we are fortunate to not participate in any meaningful way in the higher multiple investments that seem to be a bit stuck in our industry. At the same time, going back to my economics background in free markets, I do think that a lot of the allocator community has developed some great products that are going to help unlock some of this capital and convert what is value on paper to DPI, or actually cash proceeds. We've always been focused on DPI and returning capital to our investors. We did that again three meaningful times in 2024. I think we're seeing a lot of the industry now focused on how to return that capital, which I think, again, based on where we are, is going to lead to some moderation in multiples from where we were.
Absolutely. I do want to talk about how the private equity industry itself has evolved since you started Brightstar this past decade. By the way, 10-year anniversary. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd love to know how the landscape has changed, whether that's from a competition perspective or what you anticipate in terms of succession between funds itself. I'd love to know more about that.
Yeah. So we've seen a tremendous evolution in the private markets and within that private equity. It's been a great growth story overall. It's probably been differentially great depending on the sector or segment of the private markets. And I will just focus on private equity. There are a number of third-party reports out there that you can pull from some great consultants, researchers about the consistency of performance over the last 10, 20, and 40 years in the sector. If I think about the evolution of the industry going back 40 years, it essentially was a borrow a lot of money, use a little bit of equity and generate returns. And I think we've matured and evolved from there. And that market opportunity went away a long time ago. So for my generation of investors, I think we've seen an evolution to real differentiation, whether it's, again, sourcing operational value add. At the same time, we've seen this differentiation of products. If a product is more meant to be a lower risk, lower return product, there are now buckets for that private equity product. It doesn't fall within the main private equity category. We've seen the larger asset managers really aggregate and use some of their market power to create products that are a bit more retail oriented and that type of innovation. And it seems like we might be on the precipice of even some more deregulation, opening up the opportunity for all to invest in private equity. I've always admired Australia for their ability to open the access to private equity to so many, regardless of what your job is each day. And again, I think the return data is out there and is well known in terms of its relative to performance over a long period of time to the public markets. So I'm excited about what I'm seeing. It doesn't mean it's going to be exciting for all. We do read some headlines about pauses or delays or maybe fundraisers that are pulled. I think that's part of the natural life cycle or evolution of any industry. But the net trend has generally been positive, and we continue to see strong demand from our investors to invest in private equity.
Absolutely. Is there anything that I missed out on asking either about Brightstar or M&A in general? I'm sure there's a ton, but from a high level, anything that you think we should talk about?
Yeah, Nick, I think we covered a lot on Brightstar and on the industry. And obviously we want to save some material for our next conversation, but I do think I have a good story to tell.
Are you willing to tell me the craziest thing you've ever seen in your investing history?
I'm willing to tell one of the crazy things I've seen, and it'll be a personal experience. And I love reading. I remember reading Kitchen Confidential way back about how a restaurant really operates. And so I'll maybe give a little bit of a private equity confidential on the industry. And all I'll say at the outset is never take anything personally and just realize like this is a marathon, not a sprint. Again, there was a 10-year gap between meeting my wife and convincing her to date me. So a long sales cycle is okay. But early on, I was really excited at Brightstar. I had our office. It had no windows. Our team was forming. A lot of excitement and enthusiasm. Marketing materials were put together. We actually had a ton of deal flow right away. A ton of deal flow actually preceded having the capital to execute on those deals. And I think that was a testament to just having built a number of relationships. Well, on the course of this journey, you get to meet a lot of people in fund ones who are willing to take the risk of a fund one. And occasionally you might find a large institutional investor who's willing to pick up the pen. And we talk about large, we're talking about like a 9-figure commitment. So that's gargantuan. By the way, any investment gets me excited today. A 9-figure investment when you're a fund one is life-changing. So I put in the months of work, all of the diligence, ticking and tying numbers, everything that you could possibly think. And I'm told with pretty good certainty, we're talking like 90, 95%, you're going to get that 9-figure call. It was going to be on a Friday at noon, just stay by your phone, et cetera. And so I had some enthusiasm. I tried to temper it a bit, but it's pretty hard when you're thinking about how life-changing this could be. And about 30 minutes before noon, I get a call on my cell phone that says, hey, do you have a minute to speak from this institutional investor? I said, of course, it's a little earlier than I expected. No problem. They said, look, we really appreciate everything you've been doing. You've done everything we asked you to do. I don't think we can make that investment right now. So if you could think about that one crushing moment in your life when months of work had been put in, all of this, you know, anticipation of what could be life-changing, and I had to deal with it. And it was a hard call. I thanked the person for the call. You never know in life where relationships take you. And I gave myself a moment or two to regroup. And I said, basically, you got two choices here. You can kind of fold up and not deal with the challenge, or you can push forward. And that was over $5 billion ago. So it's been an exciting journey. But my observation at that time was like, for all the high highs, there are some pretty low lows. Although over time, that PERT keeps moving up to where the low lows are not as low as they might have been at that moment. But at the same time, I think it also invigorated me to want to push and try even harder. And I'm really fortunate now to have over 50 colleagues building this story and on this journey together. And again, what was life-changing then, if it didn't happen now, so be it. But it was a pretty hard one at that moment.
Oh my God, that's just heartbreaking. The patience you have to be like, okay, thank you. I'm going to put this call down and be really nice after months of work. That's wild.
I'm always reminded by people saying two things. It's not always you. So it's not always specific to the person. You never know what's going on the other side of it. And I have a good friend. I'm very active in YPO, Young Presidents Organization. I have a good friend there, a really good friend, who gave me and others the advice, never let your toughest moment define you. I was not going to let that phone call define me.
Absolutely. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for such a wonderful conversation.
Thank you again, and look forward to talking again soon.
I'm Nikita Satyaraju, senior reporter at The Deal. Thanks for tuning in to Behind the Buyouts.